I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, a Seattle City Council member declares
defund is dead.
But is it too late to recover from the mess created by that movement? Plus, Hello China, state-sponsored media, comes to Washington. And a teen killer says he feels betrayed because he has to go to an adult prison. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Praise Jesus. Words I've been waiting to hear from a Seattle City Council member for more than 3 years. Here they are.
Public safety challenges that we're experiencing today are a shameful legacy of the defund the police movement. And that was wrong then. It's wrong now. And, from my perspective, defund is dead.
10 points for Seattle City Council member Rob Sokka. And he gets all the credit because he wasn't on the city council when they talked about defunding the police in 2020 and when they continued to push that conversation in 2021. So I saw that and I thought, and you hear in the background, I'm not sure who it was, but somebody else on the dais said, and I love to hear that. And I think it's indicative of the fact that the Seattle City Council has shifted a little bit toward the middle. I mean, I'm not going to call them moderates or centrists because it's all relative, and a moderate in Seattle is still left wing elsewhere in the country. However, the acknowledgement from a council member of color, no less, that defund is dead. Let's bury it. It was a bad idea then. It's a bad idea now. That sentiment comes 3 years too late. Better late than never. Welcome to Team Sanity. That being said, after I saw it, my immediate question was, so great, but is it too late? The destruction from the defund movement, and the left and progressives, they'll always tell you, well, we didn't actually defund the police. You know, we talked about it, but we didn't actually defund the police. And I would disagree with that sentiment. I mean, there was certainly money given to other, you know, community programs and entities that should have gone to the police department and did not. But I've always said they defunded the police with their words. They defunded the police with their anti-cop vitriol, because we know what was the result of that. We'd already had a number of officers leaving the department because they'd been under the thumb of the federal government and a federal consent decree for a decade. It was exhausting. They did not feel supported by the city of Seattle. And then when the defund movement started, they started to leave in earnest. And now we're down, by latest counts, 600, 700 officers in the city of Seattle. It has destroyed public safety. It has absolutely hurt the ability to respond to violent crimes in progress. And for folks who aren't victims of violent crimes, but crimes nonetheless, they're not getting a police response. They're simply not. So what do? Well, they stop reporting things like property crimes and their window smashed in. And then the city says, oh, look. And Bob Ferguson running for governor says, oh, look, crime's down, property crime's down. It's like, no, all of that was created by the defund movement. And now we're in such a bad place with policing. People don't even call 911 anymore. So Rob Sokka's comments on defund is dead came during a briefing to the Seattle City Council on the issue of public safety. So Seattle's new interim police chief, Sue Rohr, she had a graph that I thought was actually really helpful, because we say over and over, you know, SPD's down 500 officers, then 600 officers, then 700 officers. But what does that mean? What does that actually look like out on the streets on a busy night with lots of 911 calls? And she walked the city council members through that. Listen.
This is a snapshot of a recent Saturday night, what our staffing was. You can see that we were down multiple officers in every single precinct area. In the box there where it talks about priority calls, you can see the number of priority 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 calls in each precinct area. And these calls are not small things. These are not barking dogs or speeding cars. These are assaults, crisis, domestic violence, and so forth. Many of these calls require a multiple officer response. North Precinct has been a special focus for us because of the shootings up in Aurora. And to just give you a taste of what it's like for those officers, there's 10 officers on duty for that entire precinct, which is as large as most police departments across the state, that one single precinct. So there's 10 officers to handle all of those calls. Then shortly after midnight, we get a shooting, which requires shutting down Aurora, getting a victim, getting aid to a victim. That's taking 6 or 7 officers right in that particular moment to deal with that shooting call. Meanwhile, we have all these other calls coming in. So when you hear complaints from your constituents about, you know, why does it take so long for a police officer to respond, it's a math problem. They really have to prioritize their calls, and it results in longer wait times for people getting to calls.
Yeah, I thought it was important that she acknowledged, and some of the calls officers can't get to, these are crimes in progress. These are serious crimes. These are sometimes violent crimes. That's the legacy of the police, defund the police movement. You know, this isn't behind us. Rob Sacca can declare, and I'm glad he did, defunding is dead. But defunding and the impacts of defunding are still very much alive. We're suffering through them right now, and it's going to take a lot to dig ourselves out of it. It's not going to be able to happen in the next decade. You know, and then you have this smaller number of officers, 10 officers for the entire North Precinct, as Sue Rahr said, a precinct that's the size of most other agencies in the state of Washington. And they're stretched so thin, one call, one shooting, they've got 6 or 7 of those officers taken away, only 3 left to respond to other calls in an area that's dealing with high crime, shootings, prostitution, drug issues, etc. And then how do you think those officers feel about their job? They're overworked. They're working endless overtime. Some of them are working mandatory overtime, and they're feeling worn out. So you have a shortage that's going to cause even more of a shortage as officers continue to leave, as they get lateral bonuses to go to other agencies. So the defund the police movement, just the act of people in power in 2020 having such a dislike for law enforcement that they said, we want to defund SPD by 50%. Just those words, spoke in the moment to appear woke and down with the cause, are killing people 4 years later, are leading to deaths and destruction of a once great city even 4 years later. And so when I say, is it too late to unwind defunding? I mean, I don't believe we'll ever be back in the city of Seattle to how we were a few years before the defunding movement. I don't know how you recover from that and how you get enough officers to come to the agency to keep pace with the officers who are retiring, who are leaving the profession altogether, or who are lateraling to other agencies for big fat bonuses, maybe in other states like Florida or Texas, where they actually respect law enforcement. The other thing that, you know, Sue had some good things to say, the interim police chief, but obviously they have to talk about hiring. How are we going to fix this? How are we going to get more officers to want to be Seattle police officers? Here's what she said.
We are behind where we hope to be at this point this year, and we are intensely focusing on making some changes that are going to give us a larger pool, because that is the key to getting more officers hired. We need to have a large pool of candidates so we can meet our diversity goals, so we can get the very best and brightest in the door.
Good grief. Good grief. 600, 700 officers down. You're already admitting on the front end that you're not keeping up with your hiring goals, and your focus is DEI. While people are dying, your focus is DEI. You've got your diversity goals. Like, look, I do believe that having a police department where not everyone's a white dude is important when you talk about building trust in communities. I fully agree. They have to be qualified. They have to be there. They have to exist. You know, in this idea that we're going to set these artificial goals around skin pigmentation and gender and sexual orientation, and then we're going to get this large pool so we can meet our diversity goals. You can meet any goal. Meet any goal at this point. Like, diversity at this point, when it is life or death, when you don't have enough officers to respond to life or death emergencies, the skin tone or the genitals of those officers, I promise you, it does not matter to the person whose life is in jeopardy and who's called 911. I have never wondered what kind of genitals the person responding to my 911 call has, or what the color of their skin is going to be. If you were just overfloweth with candidates, qualified candidates who wanted to be Seattle police officers, then you could afford to be choosy. Clearly you can't. The DEI diversity goals have to be set aside. Maybe forever, but set aside long enough for you to say, we have to get the most qualified, eager candidates, people who want the job, in the door, regardless of skin tone, regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of gender. And then when we're fully staffed and we're meeting our obligation to keep the public safe, then we can look, then we can go back to how do we diversify our ranks so we can have a police department that better reflects the community that we serve. It's laughable to hear the word diversity mentioned in the conversation of hiring more police officers when you're in a hole that deep. Same new police chief, same as the old police chief, same as the one before that and the one before that. They look at the political wins and DEI is all the rage and public safety takes a backseat to diversity. It's just really, really dumb. So you've got that. You've got the legacy of the police defunding movement. It's obviously the staffing issue, right? How do you recover from that? But then there's all these other elements of the criminal justice system that were devastated by that movement. And that never recovered. And the pandemic is part of this as well. I mean, I think that officials here use the pandemic as an excuse not to book people in jail. They didn't want to book people in jail anyway. I mean, Dow Constantine, the King County executive, what did he say? I want to end youth detention. They don't want, but they didn't want to. They were progressive. They don't want people in jail. So they use the pandemic, my belief is, as a reason to turn people away. And they never went back to booking. So, for instance, Cairo 7, this is insane. Cairo 7 does this story. And remember what the Seattle City Council did last year? They put an ordinance back on the books to say, yes, officers can arrest someone who is using illegal drugs out in the open. You know, we're not going to throw them in prison for 5 years, but we need some sort of stick. We got the carrot and the stick approach. We need to offer them treatment. If they don't take it, there has to be a consequence for not taking it. They have to go to jail. So it was all this, the city council back patting themselves on the back, like, yeah, we're going to deal with this open air drug crisis that's ruining the heart of the city. Well, that's great in principle, but as Cairo 7 learned in practice, it's not working so great.
We saw firsthand officers arrest a person openly using an illegal drug. Then that person was out on the streets hours later.
The person we showed you at 5 o'clock who was arrested in this very alleyway behind me, he is back out on the streets 6 hours after being arrested for openly using what police believe to be was fentanyl. And those officers actually came up to us and they're looking for him right now because he now has a felony warrant for his arrest.
Like, why even bother? Why even bother? What? You have the law on the books, but if that's what happens, officers spend their precious time. There's only a few of them. They decide, let's arrest this guy for openly using fentanyl. He's down here all the time. He's right in the heart of the tourism area of Seattle. Our city looks like shit. Crap. Sorry, Nicole. Trying my best. And let's go and let's book him and let's do this. He's out. He's back on the same corner. Cairo 7 is still out there broadcasting live for their 5 o'clock news. And the reporter looks back and he's like, that guy they just booked for using drugs on the street corner in the open, he's back here. Not only is he back here, he's smoking fentanyl again. So you have the jail not taking bookings. You have a lot of the cases that are being referred to the prosecutor's office that they're not, charges are not being filed. And I think Ann Davison, the city prosecutor, is doing a better job, obviously, than most past prosecutors, but there are still challenges. The entire criminal justice system has to work in unison, or all of this is for nothing. Councilman Rob Sacca can come and he can declare that defunding is dead, that it's a horrible legacy. Well, the legacy lives on. And so it's not enough to just say defunding is dead. It is going to take years to dig ourselves out of that absolute disaster. And so we have to focus on doing everything we can to tell police officers, we want you to be here. We need you here. We're going to support you, which is why we can't elect someone for governor like Bob Ferguson, who prosecutes police officers for fun. We have to start there. And then we have to work together as a criminal justice system to say, here is the law we have on the books. Here are the laws we have on the books. Can our officers arrest for violations of that law? Can they be booked into jail? Can they be held accountable? Can they be forced into treatment? Whatever it is. Because if any single aspect of that criminal justice wheel falls short, then it's the whole thing comes apart. So that's the failure that's happening right now. So Rob Sacca can say defunding is dead. I'm glad he said it. Amen. Love it. But the legacy of defunding is going to live on for a very, very long time. And our elected leaders have a lot of work ahead of them. So speaking of criminal justice, gosh, this story was sent to me on Friday. I couldn't believe it. Actually, I got it from State Rep Travis Couture, a good friend of the show, who has been down the throat of DCYF, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, for all their failures on a variety of fronts. But remember, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families is also responsible for our juvenile detention facilities. There was a story about 2 weeks ago, DCYF came out with a statement saying, we can't take any more bookings into our juvie facilities. Because of all the stories in recent months about them being understaffed, there's too many juvenile offenders in the facilities, they're over capacity, there's crimes going on in there, there's drug trafficking going on in there, people have tried to get firearms in, there are employees who have been caught up in some of the illicit activity, there's escapes from Echo Glen like every freaking day. So DCYF said, look, we're putting a pause. We can't take any more juvenile offenders. They're going to have to stay in county facilities or whatever it is until we sort this out. Now, it's the fault of DCYF, because what did they say for the last year as people are pointing out how bad things were within the juvie facilities? They said, no big deal. No, we got it handled. Governor Jay Inslee said, we got it handled. Law enforcement asked Governor Jay Inslee and Attorney General Bob Ferguson to investigate some of the misconduct and crimes occurring within Green Hill School, one of the two juvenile detention facilities. And what did the governor say? Ah, we got it handled. We made changes. We're on track. Clearly not, right? So all of us with a brain saw this coming. But now DCYF is in this state of disaster, even more so. And so there's two storylines here, I think. It is our juvenile justice system's failing. And it's overburdened. And those two things are connected in a sense. It's failing because it's overburdened, but also because of government incompetence. But we have juvenile crime that is just skyrocketing, and not just low-level crime where it's like teenagers acting poorly, violent crime, deadly crime, gang violence. These, you can call them kids, you can call them teens, but they're doing very adult crimes that they need to be locked up for. So there was a story by my old colleagues at Fox 13. I love you guys, but I gotta call a spade a spade. Here's the headline. Why juvenile detention crisis forces inmates into adult prisons. Quote, I feel betrayed. God. So just looking at the headline, I'm like, this is gonna be a real winner. So the story focuses around an inmate. His name is Kaya Lene. And Kaya was serving time at Green Hill School, which again is the juvenile detention facility down near Chehalis. Here is a clip talking about why Kaya feels so betrayed.
Why should this fall on our shoulders because of the solutions that they could figure out? Like, why should our rehabilitation, our safety, security, and programming, all that stuff be removed and overlooked just based off a mistake that they neglected? They neglected to try to find a solution to the overcrowding. So that was just grabbed and handcuffed and aggressively by DOC staff and escorted out of the building.
So this whole Fox 13 story centers around how Kaya, a juvenile inmate, has been celebrated by DCYF. He ended up getting a degree behind bars, and you'll notice the picture that Fox 13 chooses to use of him in a cap and gown, getting a degree while he's incarcerated, and this nice kind of headshot of him, not using a mugshot or anything like that. And in their story, Kaya is, he feels betrayed. Why should, because of overcrowding, why should we get sent to an adult prison? That's not fair to us in talking about, you know, the fear of being in an adult prison and all of those things. So because of the overcrowding situation, Kaya and 10 others were moved from Green Hill School into the Department of Corrections system. So Fox 13 does this whole sob story on this kid who's doing everything right behind bars, earning degrees. He even wrote books while behind bars, and he's just like the greatest kid. Except he's a killer. Except he murdered a woman in cold blood. And he wants to say he feels betrayed because he has to go into an adult prison for committing a murder? He murdered a woman named Julie Netchel. She was 54 years old. She lived in Everett. He killed her when he was 16 years old. It was a home invasion robbery. He came into her home when he was 16 years old, and he shot her to death. And for that, because he was a juvenile, you know what his sentence was for shooting Julie to death? 134 months. 134 months for breaking into a home and shooting a woman to death. He also, right, Nicole, shot her son in the process.
Yeah, I think the son was the original target of the robbery.
Son survived. She died. She lost her life. So a very adult crime. Julie doesn't get, you know, there's no care or concern for Julie. You know, I'm sure the family of Julie feels pretty betrayed that Fox 13 is out here talking about, oh, how great her killer is, and he earned a degree behind bars, and he wrote books, and now he has to go into an adult prison. He was sentenced in 2018 when he was 16 years old. So I don't know when his birthday is, but that puts him around 22. So he's around 22 years old. He's an adult. He's been an adult for 4 years. He committed murder. It's perfectly appropriate for him to be in an adult prison setting. Yet this is what we get in the media. Let's wax poetic and sob story about how unfair this is to him, without talking about how unfair it is that Julie's dead, how unfair it is that her son got shot. And this is this theme that we've been hearing over and over at a time of record juvenile crime. There's these sob stories about we still have to treat them like little babies. You know, we don't want them incarcerated. You know, we don't want them to go to adult prisons even after their 18th birthday, because in Washington State, you can stay. And Kaya would have been able to stay in Green Hill School as a murderer up until his 25th birthday. Because that's the law was changed in Washington State, which was part of the reason for the overcrowding, where you can be there until you're 25 in a juvie facility. So now you can have 25-year-old killers in the same juvie facility as a 15-year-old. Does that seem safe for the younger kids? Nobody's really thinking about them. I'm sick of these sob stories. And it's not the only one. Nicole was looking at old articles about this kid. This is from the Chronicle. Oh my God, I can't even stomach this. Centralia College student at Green Hill School publishes his memoirs. And it's got a picture of him there. Again, just sort of looking studious. Centralia College student and current Green Hill School inmate Kyle Lene, 22, started writing his memoir in May of 2022. He knew he wanted to write it. He knew he had a lot of support, but like many authors, he struggled to actually start the project. Quote, "When I was first thinking about writing the book, I thought it was going to be extremely difficult putting my life story on paper. The second I started, it was like the floodgates just opened. I would sit for hours and hours just typing away, not even struggling. I thought it was going to be a boring project, but it was actually a very therapeutic experience, and it helped me process and cope with many things from my past." You killed someone. And this story like barely skims over it. Like that he's in there for something that serious. It's like a footnote in the story. That's the state. Let's see. And there's more than these. I won't give you all the examples, but there were multiple examples of stories on this kid that focused on his achievements in the juvenile detention facility and totally buried that he murdered a woman in her own home in Everett in cold blood. And we're supposed to feel bad for him that he has to go into an adult facility for a very adult crime. Kaya, I don't feel bad for you. I wish you the best. Your sentence is your sentence. I think it's too low. But I'm glad that you're working on yourself behind bars. Don't get me wrong. I am glad that you got your degree behind bars. I'm glad you're writing and taking that on as a hobby. I hope that you can parlay that when you're released from prison into a productive life where you can be a contributing member of society, 100%. But none of that, none of it negates the life you took, and none of it somehow absolves you of having to serve some hard time for committing a homicide. And the media shouldn't be out there waxing poetic about your struggle when you took a woman's life. So speaking of the juvenile crime crisis, and this was the subject of our daily subscriber show poll, which I'll get to coming up later in the show, but even the Seattle Times which I think buries a lot of crime-related stories, is acknowledging that youth crime is out of control, particularly violent crime like shootings. And they'll call it gun crimes and stuff. It's gang violence, right? This headline from the Seattle Times, many more kids are being shot and killed in King County in 2024. So here's how the Seattle Times characterizes the causes of this. Easy access to guns, the proliferation of untraceable ghost guns, and switches that turn semi-automatic handguns into machine guns, widespread use of extended and drum magazines, and young people's love of gun content on social media all appear to be fueling the deadly trend. The desire and willingness to fire a gun also seems to be increasing among teens and young adults. So there's some of that where I'm like, it's just ridiculous. You know, again, they're going to talk about we need more gun control to prevent some of these gang shootings and stuff. But as we've said before, gang members are not going to follow new laws that are pushed down in Olympia. You know, you can't buy semi-automatic rifles in Washington State. And they still have them because they don't care about the laws. No matter how much, you know, Bob Ferguson pats himself on the back, all the gun control that he's helped push through in Olympia, and we still have more shootings. We still have more individual instances of shots fired. So it's just utter nonsense. But I will give the Seattle Times credit because they brought up a narrative that I think is far more likely to be the contributing factor. It's frustrating, though, because so many of you and us, we were talking about this back when the pandemic happened, about the danger of keeping kids out of school, the danger of keeping kids, especially in urban areas, out of after-school activities and healthy competition like sports, places for them to get their frustration out in a healthy, constructive way. So here's what the Seattle Times says about this. And I agree with everything here. I just think they're a little late to the party on it. Athletic programs have also been casualties to the pandemic, said Dom Davis, the founder and executive director of Community Passageways, a community nonprofit that works to keep young people, particularly Black and brown kids, out of the criminal legal system. Basketball, football, and track programs have all but disappeared in Seattle's Central District and South End, and with them, practices, workout sessions, and out-of-town tournaments that can stave off attempts to draw young men into the streets. He said, quote, "We had kids during the pandemic sitting up on their devices all day, watching all the gang life stuff because that's what gets promoted on social media. Gang, 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 gang. Instead of being complimented for their hard work on good plays and getting a resulting hit of serotonin from those accomplishments," Davis said, "it switched to, oh, he's a hitter, he's a stepper, he's a shooter." Quote, "Now that camaraderie, that positive affirmation comes from a negative place, but you're still getting the same chemicals in your brain." 100%, that's what's going on. Now, we had youth gang violence before the pandemic, certainly. But this was one of the many narratives that people who were vilified for saying kids have to get back to school was what? Mental health, right? This is the risk to kids with their mental health, how far they're going to be put back in education, far outweighs the risk that COVID posed to healthy young people. And if you dared bring that up, you were right-wing, Trumpster, wanted people to die, whatever it was. And then again, for kids in the inner city, for kids in areas with high levels of gang violence, who the only reason they're not out on the streets being lured into the gang life is because they're at school, they're playing basketball, they're playing football, they're in after-school clubs and tournaments. All of that went away for several years, and some of it didn't come back, especially some of the outside-of-school extracurriculars that lost funding, and then there was obviously no interest because the pandemic and tournaments weren't happening, and they never returned. So our state's handling of the pandemic is absolutely part of why we're seeing so many young people shot and killed on our streets right now. So many young people stealing cars at record rates, you know, committing drive-by shootings at record rates. Yet you'll never see any acknowledgement of that from Governor Inslee. You'll never hear any acknowledgement of that from Bob Ferguson, the Attorney General. They'll continue to blame it on what they've always blamed it on: guns. They'll continue to push for what they've always pushed for as a way to make our streets safer: gun control, But Jay Inslee has been the governor for 12 years. Bob Ferguson has been the attorney general for 12 years. As a way to improve public safety, they've focused predominantly on gun control. Yet we have a worse public safety crisis now than we've ever had before, particularly when it comes to crimes committed with a firearm. So I don't have to tell you it's not working. You can look at their record for yourself and you can realize that it's not working. And young people are paying the price for that with their lives. All right, coming up next, we're going to have a clip from a candidate for public office running in a Washington State House district that I am very, very interested in the outcome of. I'm sure some of you have already guessed which district that is. First, I have talked a lot about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, eastsideweightlossclinic.com, eastsideweightlossclinic.com. I'm down 40 pounds. I've kept the weight off for a year and a half, and I hear so many wonderful stories from people who have taken the program saying it changed their life, it gave them their energy back. I mean, usually people don't even lead with how much weight they lost. They lead with, like, I feel better, I'm sleeping better, I have more energy, I have more confidence, I'm out doing more things. I mean, we've talked to our friend Ben and his wife Leslie. They, like, went out and ran marathons their whole life change. So if you've been thinking about trying the program, there is no time like the present. It's 60 days of really hard work followed by some simple lifestyle changes. So eastsideweightlossclinic.com, schedule your free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team today. All right, it's time to talk about Lion Clyde Shavers. So if you were a fan of Undivided back when I first launched the show, you will recall just how many episodes I spent talking about Lion Clyde Shavers. He is the current state representative for the 10th Legislative District. He is a Democrat, and he is a liar. He inflated his military service, and it didn't come out until ballots had already been mailed out, which was the frustrating thing, I think, for residents of Snohomish County, which is predominantly where this is, and some on in Kitsap County as well, that... He served in the military. I think that's what's also just ridiculous. But he felt the need to inflate his service in the Navy. It was uncovered. Ballots had already been out for, I think, a week, week and a half. A lot of people had already voted. And he didn't win by very much. And Clyde Shavers has never really come out with a mea culpa. He's got his seat. Democrats didn't say jack. You know, at the time, I remember we were trying to press Democrats to condemn him. You know, there were a couple individual Democrats who said, yeah, he needs to come out and he needs to correct the record. But really, they were just happy to have him take a Republican seat. They were happy to have him in the House. They put him on the Veterans Committee, which was like, oh, just a stab in the heart to veterans who were livid over this. So I have it out for Lion Clyde Shavers. Make no mistake about it. So one of the people running against Clyde Shavers in the 10th Legislative District is a woman named Yvonne Gallardo. She is also a veteran. She also served in the Navy. The difference is that she has not lied about her service. We have an interview with Yvonne that is going to be posted in its entirety this evening, but I wanted to give you a preview of it today. So when you found out that he had not been fully honest about his military service, as a veteran yourself, how did it strike you?
I was pretty pissed off.
Yeah.
It's really hard sometimes to really think about why lie. Mm-hmm. Why, you already served your country, and just be proud of what you did. It's embarrassing to hear and see anybody that, if you're willing to lie about something that can actually be fact-checked very easily, right? Yeah. What else are you willing to lie about? Mm-hmm. But as a veteran to you, and as somebody who went out and served on Westpacs and knows people who have not come home, mm-hmm. who did not get to come home. And to be able to, how do you lie about a service that you think is just a title, but it's a title that may have made that person go overseas and fight a fight that they may not have come home from, mm-hmm. and, or wearing a ribbon that you didn't earn. Like, people have given so much for those ribbons or for that title. And it's a sacrifice that shouldn't be stolen from them. And it's hard.
Have you heard from constituents as you've been going out campaigning?
Yes.
Because I think there's this question about, have people forgotten? You know, is that sort of yesterday's news? They have not.
They have not. No, and it's funny because even when it all happened and went down a few years ago, like, I was in the room when it was like, oh my gosh, Yvonne, did you see what just happened? Mm-hmm. And it was, what is this? And then why? And so then I was upset about mm-hmm. it. And then a few others in the room were upset about it. And little by little, I mean, walk into any Legion and ask them what they think about it and see how the reaction is. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you've actually put this narrative out there, which I think is really good, which you kind of articulated there. There's no reason to lie. Any service to our nation done honorably is worthy.
It is.
It's always weird to me that you've already done it. Like, you have something to be proud of. You don't have to embellish it. To that end, and you may have seen my segments, I have been very hard on Semi Byrd, the gubernatorial mm-hmm. candidate, for some of the allegations that have come out about him, for his admission to actions that amount to defrauding the U.S. Army. I had on the chair of the state Republican Party at the time about it. My frustration, and I brought you up by name, is, you know, here you have a great candidate against Clyde Shavers. The easiest knock against Clyde is that he lied about his military service. And I felt like the Republican Party excusing those lies would take away from you and your campaign's ability to say, well, Clyde Shavers lied. Is there, how the Clyde aside, the Semi Byrd accusations, as a member of the military, how do you feel about those?
Exact same way I just said before. Don't, if you did not earn that, don't put the badge on, don't put the ribbon on, don't put the medal on. You did not earn it. And it's easy to walk into any exchange and buy a ribbon and put it on. And if you're lying about that, what else are you lying about? What else are you hiding? It's too hard. It's too hard to, it's too many points against you, I guess. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like your party, the Republican Party, has been forceful enough about Semi Byrd?
Depends on what room, I guess, you're in. Yes, but they could definitely be pushing it a little bit harder.
Mm-hmm. Does it hurt your ability to speak out about Clyde Shavers and his stolen valor if the Republican Party can't even muster condemnation of Semi Byrd's stolen valor?
Yes.
That is Yvonne Gallardo. She is a candidate for State House in the 10th Legislative District. Our conversation is going to be up in full across our subscription platforms this evening. No paywall. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com, so you can watch it when it's up. And I think it's an important conversation. That's why I always talk about moral consistency. Like, you got to look at the action, not the affiliation. And I grilled Jim Walsh about it on this show, the chair of the state Republican Party. How can you be so dismissive of the credible accusations that Semi Byrd lied about his military service when you have a seat that Republicans could pick up in the 10th Legislative District, but one of the key knocks against the Democrat is that he committed stolen valor? So it's like, you can't have it both ways. You can't be like, well, I'm ignoring stolen valor over here, but when it's the Democrat, I mean, when Clyde Shavers was elected, Republicans were pushing to try to get him removed from his position. They like introduced a law or a bill or something, it didn't get anywhere, that like you can't serve if you've committed an act of stolen valor. So they wanted Republicans wanted everybody to take it seriously at the time. And I took it seriously because I think it is serious. But now it's like, you know, the person they've endorsed for governor and Semi Byrd, all this evidence of stolen valor, and they're like, we'll kind of look the other way. It's not like the end of the world. So it's incredible moral hypocrisy. And I don't think it helps Yvonne Gallardo at all in her effort to flip the 10th Legislative District back to Republicans. All right, coming up next, we'll get to our segment, Unfreaking Believable, as Washington State takes a page out of China's playbook. First, if you're in the market to sell your home, you can do that with our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. He recommends, he says, inventory is increasing a little bit. So some of those, like, you know, if you list your home right now and you're going to have a lot of people jumping and it's going to push bids up. But as inventory increases, that's going to stop a little bit. So he says, if you're going to sell your home at some point in 2024, he recommends doing it sooner rather than later.
King County, median $1 million. Homes are still selling very, very quickly. If you want to do something this year, give me a call. I'd love to start the process now. I think that things will be moving very swiftly through probably October. And then as the election starts to come out, you know, get closer, people always pump the brakes. But for all of you who are out there that are thinking like, oh, you know, I can't sell my home because I need X amount, you're probably at the peak right now. You know, it's probably worth more than it's ever been than previous times. So what are you waiting for?
What are you waiting for? So check out Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com. He'll start by giving you a market analysis for free, just so you know how your home is positioned, depending on where it is. And then you can use their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. You know what will really fix the crisis of confidence in media in Washington State and beyond? I think going down the Chinese, North Korea model of state-sponsored media will really do the trick. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Boop! All right, so Democrats in Washington State have been panicking a little bit, trying to figure out what can we do to prop up some of these old media institutions that have been very favorable to us because they're folding. You know, newspapers are dying. You've got TV stations where ratings are lower than they've been because it's just sort of an outdated model. They haven't kept up with the times. And I believe that people are getting more wise to the grift, more wise to just how biased some media coverage is. So what has happened in Washington State? Well, you've had people like Bob Ferguson who are supporting tax breaks for legacy media groups, et cetera. And, you know, that's one thing. And I've said on the show that is absolutely, it's like the separation of church and state. I mean, media outlets whose job it is to hold powerful people and politicians accountable shouldn't be taking a dime from the government. And so I'm firmly against that. Any sort of tax breaks or incentives or anything like that given to media outlets, I am opposed to, unless it is a public access station, unless it's a channel that the government funds that shows you city council meetings and shows you committee hearings in Olympia, because that's different, right? So we want the public to be able, we want increased government transparency. And so if the government's going to pay for a channel where you can tune in and watch a vote on the floor, that's totally different. That's not what we're talking about here. So tax breaks and those sorts of incentives, it's already bad enough. But now Washington State is going into full-blown state-sponsored, not journalism, state-sponsored journalists, which is even more terrifying. This from our friends over at the Linwood Times. State-funded journalism is here in Washington State. By summer's end, 16 journalism fellows will begin their two-year state-funded fellowship led by the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University. The fellows will travel to newsrooms across the state to cover multiple news deserts where underserved communities lack access to local journalism. The fellowship is modeled after the recently established California Local News Fellowship. Yeah, because doing anything California does is a great idea, which bankrolls 40 career journalists out of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. The California Fellowship began as a response to the state's own journalism crisis, where one in four news publications ceased operations between 2004 and 2019, according to the University of North Carolina. So again, modeled after California, which bankrolls 40 career journalists out of UC Berkeley. And the newsrooms that are hiring state-sponsored journalists through a program out of UC Berkeley, those are going to be very left-leaning publications. And of course, the question here at the center of all of this is, can you remain unbiased? To what extent is this just, we're going to write you a check to do it, go ahead, do your things, or is there going to be a pressure to almost train these journalists to cover things in a certain way or to cover certain issues? You know, we're going to write these checks, but you got to have a climate reporter. You've got to train someone in covering the climate or in covering social justice. We know that some of the stations in 2020 created positions for social justice reporters. So I can see Washington State government doing that. We'll give you the funds to go to school for journalism, but we want you to graduate with a focus in covering climate issues, social justice, whatever it is. Reading on in the Linwood Times article, the WSU Fellowship, financed by a new $2.4 million apportionment in state funds, has been championed by, oh, shock of the century, Democrats, Senator Karen Kaiser, a Democrat from Des Moines, and Senator Marco Elias, our favorite liar, a Democrat from Edmonds. Quote, a strong press is fundamental to a thriving democracy, said Kaiser, herself a graduate of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Yet, she says, Washington has lost 20% of its newspapers over the past two decades. That means in many communities, school board meetings aren't being covered, court proceedings aren't being scrutinized, and local government actions aren't being questioned. This from the party that is withholding documents from journalists in Olympia on a regular basis. This from lawmakers who tried to exempt themselves from the Public Records Act, which was passed by initiative by voters in this state in the 1970s. This from a party that has been the opposite of transparent. Now, you want to give government funds to create journalists in your image, and you want to wax poetic about how a strong press is fundamental to our democracy, and we need to make sure that the government is scrutinized and government actions are questioned. This from someone like Senator Marco Elias, who lies on a weekly basis about what repealing the Climate Commitment Act would do in the state of Washington. We've demonstrated those lies in the past. He uses his government social media account to spew lies. And you really think that he wants to fund journalists like us, or journalists who would be critical of some of the things that he says and does? Like, not a chance in the world. You also don't, and when, you know, they floated tax breaks, for instance, to newsrooms like the Seattle Times, and then the Seattle Times editorial board turned around and endorsed Bob Ferguson for governor. Really, despite the fact that the editorial board has disagreed with him on a ton of things, it really makes you wonder whether newsrooms that get money from the government are capable of covering the government in the way it needs to be covered. I think the answer is probably no, based on a track record. But there's also another issue in here. When they talk about how Washington has lost 20% of its newspapers over the last two decades, whenever we talk about media failing, right? Whenever we talk about newspapers closing, ratings being down, not enough money there, layoffs, there's been a ton of layoffs in newsrooms across the country and as of late in Washington State. No one wants to talk about why the model isn't financially feasible anymore. No one wants to have that conversation. Media, they criticize everyone and everything else, but they don't want to use an ounce of introspection to say, why aren't we profitable anymore? Why have we lost so many subscribers? Why don't we have as many advertisers anymore? As a boss once told me, content is king. And their content is flawed, it's biased, it's not as good as it once was. And people see that. I get messages all the time and responses and comments saying, oh, I just dropped my Seattle Times subscription. I just dropped my Herald subscription over this story or that story. Polling and surveys have shown that there is a lack of trust in media. It's worse at the national level than it is at the local level because they feel a little more connected to local outlets and local reporters than they do national reporters. But across the board, trust in the press is at an all-time low. So instead of saying, okay, how can we fix that? How can we earn subscribers back and therefore get more clicks, get more views, and be able to earn our advertisers back? Instead of that, they want handouts from the government. Instead of that, they want ways to fix the problem without fixing the problem. Because you can send these state-sponsored reporters to a newsroom like the Seattle Times, right? Or to a news desert somewhere to do reporting. But when their fellowship is done and they go to get a job in journalism, they're going to be trying to get a job in journalism in the exact same market where journalism is failing, in the exact same environment, because you never asked yourselves, you never fixed the issue. Why do you, we've said this a million times, why do you think Nicole and I can do this full time? This is our job, which is a freaking blessing. We can do this full time because enough people value the content that we're putting out there that they'll pay $5 a month for it. And because enough people will pay $5 a month for this show and it gets enough views, we can bring in advertisers. If there was a point in time where we were losing advertisers or we were losing subscribers, we would stop and have a difficult conversation and ask ourselves, what is going wrong with our show? We wouldn't ask for handouts to prop up a failing product. We would have to ask ourselves, are we not covering things in the way they need to be covered? You know, we're never going to like, oh, we better be nice to whoever, whatever politician it is, because it seems like people want us to go more to the right or go more to the left. We're never going to do that. I'm never going to change how I feel about issues or, you know, give people lip service. Like, we lost semi-bird people from the show who like would message me and say, I just dropped my subscription because you've been critical of semi-bird and you endorse Dave Reichert. Fine. Those are losses that I understand. And that I can't do anything about Because if I lose subscribers by telling what I think is the truth, then there's really no way around that. But there's never, never been any willingness to have introspection in the media about what's going on, about why the business model is failing, and that's why the business model will continue to fail. And one of the things I told my agent when I left my job at Fox 13 was I need to get off that sinking ship. I had a lot of other issues with our coverage around the pandemic, around the summer of love, and acting like, oh, nothing happened at the riots in Seattle and all is well. But one of the big reasons was I saw the ship a-sinking, and I didn't want to sink with it like the captain of the Titanic. So I jumped off, got in a rowboat, and paddled out of there like hell. And here we are, having a hell of a good time. All right, coming up next, we'll get to some national news or daily subscriber poll, comments, questions from all of you, which, by the way, did you notice anyone that we're streaming our show live on X today? Thank you, Elon Musk. I shouldn't do that because that's like the guy, the wrestling guy. Remember? Did you watch professional wrestling when you were a kid?
I actually did in high school.
I did too. Remember the guy who did the like, suck it?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He would do it down here, though. Like, we watched that as kids, and he'd be like, X, he'd be like, suck it. Somebody will tell us.
Yeah, I forget.
Because, like, that's kind of gross in hindsight. We were kids cheering him on, like, oh, he says suck it. And then my little brother would go around the house. So I was trying to, anyway, I was trying to make the X symbol. And
the hoe train.
Oh, the hoe train. Wow. Bring some of that. Make the hoe train great again. I love it. But yeah, thanks, Elon Musk. We're now streaming the show live on X. So if you always click on the link on X, you don't have to go anywhere anymore. You can just watch it live. So love it. Speaking of loving things, First Mark Insurance, love it. Why? Because it is a superior product, a superior service. The insurance market is crazy right now. Chances are if you've gotten renewal letters that your rates have gone up for auto insurance, for homeowners insurance. And so if you're dealing with your insurance on your own, you should be using an insurance broker to help you navigate this market. First Mark Insurance is a great broker. They've been doing it in Washington State for a long time. I'm a member of the First Mark family. Undivided is insured through the First Mark family. There's a reason for that. We've heard from so many of you who have taken the First Mark challenge and are so glad you did. Casey says they saved us 37% off our auto quote for the same coverage. Right now, every dollar counts. Maggie says that Levi at First Mark reviewed her car and home insurance. He recommended a new bundle that was half the cost and better coverage. And the very, very best part is you never pay First Mark anything for their services. You don't pay for the First Mark challenge, and you don't pay First Mark insurance for them handling your insurance needs. And it just saves you so much time, energy, hand-wringing, all of that. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. They work for you. All right, Bibi Netanyahu was in Congress today, and there was all this leading up to his visit. And look, I get it. There is some agreement I'm going to have with some of the rationale people gave for boycotting his address to Congress. However, at the end of the day, this is an ally of the United States. It's an ally engaged in a conflict. It's an ally that has citizens that are still being held hostage. American citizens are still being held hostage. And so, you know, for so many people to throw a little temper tantrums, and here's Netanyahu coming in to the joint session of Congress
Speaker,
today to offer
his remarks. The Prime Minister of the State of Israel.
So he got an applause. That was nice. And we were doing the show, obviously. He came in. It was 11 p.m. Pacific time, so I haven't gotten a chance to see if there were any sort of outbursts or otherwise misbehavior while Netanyahu was in front of Congress. But notably absent from his remarks was the apparent Democratic presidential nominee and the vice president of the United States, Kamala Harris. So she's, of course, the president of the Senate when she's there, and this is would be her responsibility to be there when a world leader comes to speak before Congress, but she was not there, according to Fox News. She instead was attending the Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Grand Boule in Indianapolis, Indiana. They said it was pre-planned. I think there's some arguments to be made that maybe that's the kind of thing that she reschedules if Netanyahu is coming. But as is with Harris's absence, the task would have fallen to the Senate President pro tem, which is none other than Washington State Senator Patty Murray. However, she refused to do it. She decided to boycott the address. In the absence of both Harris and Murray, the session will instead and was instead presided over by Senator Ben Cardin, a Democrat from Maryland who is retiring after this Congress. So they're like, put up the guy who is retiring and has nothing to lose. But I think it just shows that they're that worried. Democrats are that worried about the far left fringe of their party who would lose their minds if they even showed up to a joint address in Congress from an ally. It shows that anti-Semitism is prevalent within the Democratic Party, truly. But I'll say it wasn't just Democrats that decided to boycott. So I just want to read two competing statements, one from Congresswoman Primla Jayapal of our state, progressive chair of the Progressive Caucus, and then also Republican Representative Thomas Massie said, I'm not coming. Like, I'm not going to this thing. And so, you know, their reasons are obviously a little bit different. But let's see here. Jayapal said, Prime Minister Netanyahu should not have been invited to come and speak to the U.S. Congress. I cannot in good conscience sit and listen to him speak as Palestinian people starve and hostages, including Israelis and Americans, remain in captivity. He has used U.S. taxpayer dollars for a horrific assault on Gaza and the Palestinian people and continued to flout both international and humanitarian law and our own U.S. domestic law in denying humanitarian assistance to Gaza. So it just all goes on in that regard. And then Thomas Massie, who's very anti-war, he said, today Congress will undertake political theater on behalf of the State Department. The purpose of having Netanyahu address Congress is to bolster his political standing in Israel and to quell international opposition to his war. I don't feel like being a prop, so I won't be attending. Like, you do you, honestly. It's not the end of the world. I think it's a little bit, for Democrats, I think there are a lot of Democrats who are simply worried, because Patty Murray, she does not strike me as the far left sort of anti-Semitic pro-Hamas fringe at all. But she even said, I'm not going to preside over it. So she must be worried about some electoral consequences if she were to do so. It's just a really weird way to make an ally feel welcome. That's sort of where I settle on it. One other thing I want to just point out. You know, whenever there's a protest these days in the state capitol, Republicans invariably call it an insurrection and call for people to be arrested because people call January 6th an insurrection. To be honest, it just sort of bothers me. January 6th was a national embarrassment. Police officers were assaulted. A peaceful protest in our nation's capital, which is the People's House, is just fine. Now, I'm not saying there aren't going to be, the day is young. I'm not saying there not might not be acts of violence. I saw some videos of people outside. Yes, Nicole?
Oh, I saw cops pepper spraying people a
little bit earlier.
Oh,
so that must have happened since. But there was this one video in particular. Can you play the video from yesterday? Like, that's not comparable to J6 people. And it just looks, it makes you look unhinged when you compare it to January 6th. So it sounds like there's some other stuff happening. But people were saying, oh, arrest these insurrectionists, get them out of there. Let's just calm down. I love it. People protesting peacefully in a house that belongs to us, in a building that belongs to us, I have no issue. Disrupting things, I have no issue. But like when you're coming in there assaulting police officers, breaking windows, trying to break into Senate chambers, et cetera, that's kind of a different thing. But yeah, I guess we'll monitor because there's a lot of police that have been called in, and rightfully so. Look at how violent some of the anti-Israel protests have been. I mean, you go to the campus of the University of Washington and the scary hate that was spewed there. I mean, like, you know, celebrating Hamas, yeah, they better bring in a bunch of police officers. There's like 100, some video of 100 NYPD officers being sworn in. So I guess we're on the air. So we'll see what happens from now through the end of the day. But certainly, if you have anti-Israel protesters who force their way into the nation's capital, who break things, who assault people, then yeah, then that's similar. Then we're talking about a similar situation, and we'll see if Democrats treat it as such. All right, one more quick national story for you. It's the media has failed. It's irredeemable. It's really irredeemable. there are some outlets that are fine. There are some local news stations that are fine. I don't hate the media. I don't hate all members of the media. But the national media in particular has utterly failed. So when I said on the show Monday, I think it was, when it became clear Kamala Harris was going to be the choice to replace Joe Biden, please, conservative media, do not focus on her laughing and her dancing and her sleeping with some dude in California who was married to get ahead. Like, those are easy things to focus on. But there are so many policy failures that you can focus on that will actually resonate with the American people and won't turn off voters. And one of those things is very obviously the border. We know that Kamala Harris was placed in charge of the border crisis by President Joe Biden. And the media at large knows that. But now, and so that's a huge failure on her record. She was tasked with dealing with the situation at the southern border. She was aghast that NBC News, there was that interview with her and Lester Holt, that he would ask her why she hadn't been to the border. And she responded, why you ask me? I don't get it. I mean, I haven't been to Europe either. It's like, no, you were put in charge of the border as the borders are. So it's kind of weird you haven't been to the border. So now, knowing that that's a huge shortcoming for Kamala Harris, right? That is easy for Republicans to knock her on. Now the media is circling the wagons and saying, well, she wasn't really the border czar, right? Republicans are just saying that, and it's totally a lie. Here's a tweet from Axios yesterday. The Trump campaign and Republicans have tagged Harris repeatedly with the, quote, border czar title, which she never actually had. Similar sentiments on CNN and other outlets saying Republicans are just making up this border czar title. That's so weird. Why are they doing that? She's like, they're distancing her from the border crisis. Except, it didn't take long for the internet to point out that Axios had also called her the border czar. In 2021, they said Harris, appointed by Biden as border czar, said she would be looking at the root causes that drive migration. Wow, that's interesting. So then that was pointed out. Axios got community noted on X, and then they had to update their story that they had tweeted out yesterday with an editor's note. This article has been updated and clarified to note that Axios was among the news outlets that incorrectly labeled Harris a border czar in 2021. Now, why are you saying it was incorrect? Was it incorrect then, or is it incorrect now to say that she was not named the border czar? And even if that wasn't the official title, border czar, czar is just a word for in charge of something. She was put in charge of the border by President Biden, and he made a big deal out of it. Oh, I trust her so much. This is going to be one of her big responsibilities. And now it's like, well, that didn't go well. So since she's running for president, everyone in the media has to fall in line and say that she didn't actually have any responsibilities at the southern border. Absolutely insane. You know who I want to talk to about this? Our friend Allie Bradley with News Nation, the only person I trust to tell me any freaking thing about what's happening at the southern border is our friend Allie Bradley with News Nation. And maybe Bill Malusian with Fox. Sure. Bill Malusian with Fox, Allie Bradley with News Nation. Anyone else who wants to talk to me about the border in the news, earmuffs. Earmuffs. All right. We'll get to our daily subscriber show poll and comments coming up next. First, tomorrow. It's happening tomorrow. Our friend Zach Abraham at Bulwer Capital is having an inflation webinar. 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. You can sign up for free, knowyourriskradio.com. What happens on a webinar? Well, let me tell you. You log in for free, sign up for it. Again, knowyourriskradio.com. Knowyourriskradio.com. It may make it so easy. A little thing pops up in the middle of the screen and says, do you want to come to our webinar? And you just hit yes and you register for it. And you can just passively listen in. And what they're going to talk about is how inflation can be a silent portfolio killer. You've planned, you've saved, you've scraped for the retirement of your dreams. But then inflation hits, and all of a sudden, the money that you've saved isn't going to go as far. So how can you manage that? How can you plan for that? How can you assess the risk involved in that? That's what Zach and his team are just going to sit and talk about. And then if you'd like, you can ask them some questions as well. It's free, you know, no obligations or anything like that. So you can come away with just some really good information, especially if you're getting close to retirement, on how to deal with this inflationary environment. So don't miss the inflation webinar tomorrow, July 25th. 3:30 p.m. Pacific time, knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244, go to knowyourriskradio.com. All right, our daily subscriber show poll today. has, I almost forgot what it was. Here it is. It's on juvenile crime. Thank you. So, of course, we talked about the spike in juvenile crime, and not just any juvenile crime. We're not talking about kids taking a car for a joyride or, you know, stealing a soda from the 7-Eleven. We're talking about murders and gang shootings and drive-bys and motor vehicle theft, etc. So I asked you on Patreon Locals and X, Washington State seeing a spike in violent crime involving juveniles, of the choices provided, which do you believe is the biggest contributor to this trend? Proliferation of guns, bad parenting, economic stressors, or social media and gaming? Let's go over to Patreon first. 82% saying poor parenting. I'm surprised by that.
That's what I was going to say.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean because all of that that's kind part of goes of it.
In, yeah, like the social media gaming, it's parents that are allowing too much of it. I think it can all go back to not, I mean, there are some circumstances where, you know, a parent did everything that they can, but I think that it's,
yeah, at the end of the day, where's your kid?
Yeah.
Like, is he out with a gun, you know, shooting other people at midnight on Alki Beach? So yeah, maybe
you have dinner with him every night and talk about his day.
I definitely think that poor parenting can be fed by economic stressors. And so I do believe economic stressors in the inner city is a big reason why people turn to a life of crime, because some gang members who are young, their parents were gang, their dad was a gang member, you know, and so that's just sort of the life they were born into. And what have we said a million times before I get to your comments, which is the point of the Daily Subscriber show poll after all? What have I said before about this? Like, we live in a state, and really, I think as a nation, there is this narrative that if the color of your skin isn't white, that there's nothing you can do to better your circumstances, and the system is designed to hold you down. So I think we feed these kids at every turn in school, the government, on the news, social media, that if you are black, then the system is stacked against you. And so why would you go out and try to work hard and get an education and better yourself if you've been told over and over and over again that, no, you're not white, so you're just kind of screwed? Then you're just like, okay, I'm just going to do what my dad did or my uncle did. I'm going to beg, borrow, and cheat, and I'm going to be a gang member or whatever it is. So I think economic stressors, we need to find a way. Not reparations, Nicole. We need to find a way to, one, convince and change the narrative that, no, you can be anything you want to be. The color of your skin is not a barrier to success in the United States of America. We need to change that narrative from the top to the bottom. Anyone pushing that narrative is destructive, is actually harming people of color. It's the, what did Dory call it?
The soft bigotry of low expectations.
The soft bigotry, which actually I think is from a George Bush speechwriter. But Dory used that phrase all the time. Soft bigotry of low expectations. It is bigoted. It is racist to suggest, like the system, you can never get past that. So we need to change that first. And then, yes, I do believe President Trump did this a lot, trying to invest in helping in disadvantaged areas, people of color start businesses and build wealth and be able to afford home ownership, not through reparations. I think economic stressors has a lot to do with it. Let's see what you say, though, shall we? Let me see here. It's like I can't use my mouse today. Slim Jakey says, none of them. My biggest issue is how they have no consequences for their actions these days. You can't pick none of them. That's why I don't put an option that says none of them. You got to pick one of them. But I agree that on top of that, when you look at juveniles and you've got a juvenile offender literally getting airtime on Fox 13 because he's complaining after he murdered a woman that he has to go into an adult prison. That's the narrative that we're sending to juvenile offenders. Remember the time there was that kid who committed a drive-by shooting and he was horrified that he wasn't going to get sent home on electronic home monitoring because his buddy did when he committed a drive-by shooting? You don't think that they know those things? When they can steal, what was it, down in Enumclaw, I want to say, somewhere in Thurston County, where kids were stealing, the same kids were stealing dozens of cars.
Enumclaw.
The parents didn't even care. They blamed the police. The kids would go in. Judge would cut them loose. No bail. Parents don't care, no bail, no consequences. Why wouldn't you keep stealing cars? So I do agree, no consequences is a big part of it. Let me see here. Mark says, poor parenting and then no consequences. There needs to be stiffer sentences. That particular teen felon may never be reformed, but a severe sentence may show his peers that crime is not a wise choice. I agree. You have to set a standard. We have laws for a reason. As the Seattle City Attorney, Ann Davison, says, Our laws are our values. If we're not enforcing our laws, then we're not enforcing our values as a society. Let's see. Rico says lack of police, lack of judges that hammer the juveniles, lack of parenting. Aaron says economic stressor is what she chose. With parents working more, there is a lack of supervision. Parents may not know what their kids are up to, or they do, but they have to get out the door to support their family anyway. It's a lot of factors, but parents working more is definitely contributing. And I agree with that, too. And that goes across race, right? Like, I grew up in a poor white family. And, I mean, my dad was home a lot because he lost jobs because he drank so much, but he wasn't monitoring us. He was drunk half the time. And then my mom was working hard to raise not only four kids, but my alcoholic father. And so, yes, my siblings and I got into an awful lot of trouble. As I've said on the show, we were not the best teenagers or young adults, but here I am today.
They all turned out all right.
We've turned out fine, like more or less, like, you know, I guess.
Given the tools, you know.
Sometimes beautiful butterflies are...
well,
hatched out of hardship.
There you go. I think that it's also, parents can't always be there because of economic things, whatever. You can't, you know, you can't be there 100% of the time, but you have to instill those things in your children in different ways. Find ways to instill good things.
God, speaking of, can we just tease? Can we tease this special we're working on?
Yeah.
You guys, I met the coolest kids last night. I'm not going to say specifics. I don't want any sort of school district to get their panties in a bunch. You know how we've been doing...
their panties are already in a
bunch. The school district knows which one it is. You know how we've been doing a ton of investigative stories on school districts pushing political and social agendas on kids and all of that? So we've been doing these stories every couple weeks. Well, we're going to work on a special report where, you know, we've talked to former teachers. We've talked to parents. We have kids... on the record, we went down to a location yesterday, interviewed four students about their... Nicole's like, you're just giving it away. Interviewed four students of varying ages about their experience in a local school district. And these kids, I was so freaking proud of them. It made me want to have kids like today. Because I was like, these kids, some of them were pretty young. And I'm like, they are so articulate. Their parents clearly taught them right and wrong. Their parents clearly taught them to speak up and stand up for themselves when they feel like something is wrong. And they are able to articulate so well some of the batshit stuff that happens in our school districts. It's the most powerful thing, I think, when it comes to looking at the failure of our school system and how you have this indoctrination of kids. It's coming from the kids. The kids feel indoctrinated. And they're going to tell you how they feel indoctrinated. So that'll be coming up in a couple weeks on Undivided. So we'll make sure we'll keep you apprised. Why do I forget the words I'm searching for so much? It's my concussions. It's my head injuries.
Probably it.
I really have a hard time with my metaphors. I need a list
of metaphors.
Can you give me a list of metaphors so when I'm trying to use one?
You just have to search it all the time. Let me see which one am I looking for.
Yes, exactly. Okay, questions, comments from the live stream. Matt Gilbert with a $10 super chat. Well, I could be wrong, but I believe diversity is an old, old wooden ship that was used during the Civil War era. That's Ron Burgundy. I forgot that is a Ron Burgundy quote. Lisa Slobodizin with a $9.99 super chat for the swear jar. I appreciate that. I did swear twice on the show today. Mm-hmm. I apologize to my loving husband who thinks I'm far too elegant to be swearing. But sometimes you just can't help it. On SPD, Merwin Wren says the defund movement completely turned off my son from law enforcement permanently. Police assaulted by activists and prosecuted when they respond. CHOP, CHAZ, DEI, this and more lost him and many. If you feel like your bosses don't have your back, if you feel like you could be prosecuted for making the wrong decision sometimes in a split second moment where your life's on the line, why would you do that job?
I've heard from many cops that when they get, you know, there was a couple cops in Vegas that we met and they didn't want to tell us their real jobs because they were cops and they don't know how you're going to react to that.
Yeah.
And I just think that's sad, right? So they're embarrassed.
You should be proud of it.
You should be proud. Yeah. I don't know about embarrassed, but nervous to be seen as a cop because you don't know how people are going to react.
Like, you can get kicked out of the bar, restaurant won't serve you, someone will call you racist and a pig and they'll oink at you.
That's the environment we've created, I guess, or these politicians have created.
It's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, oinking.
Sometimes
terrible.
As a joke, I oink when I see officers. Don't admit but to it's that. Fine. I do it as
I
a
wasn't
joke.
Gonna call you out.
I do it as a joke in private. I love law enforcement. Okay. from Twitter Live, which, yes, we love having Twitter Live. You don't have to navigate to so many different platforms. TOA says, on the Rob Sokka quote, credit where credit is due, taking out the defund trash that the last council left behind. And it takes... At some point, I think that's a good starting point. Like, the defund is behind us. And he said it was a bad idea then. It's a bad idea now. He wasn't part of it, so he gets to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, if it was a council member who was here during defund and supported it, or even worse, said nothing while other people supported and pushed it, then I would not be celebrating them saying defund is dead. Absolutely not. But he's not one of them. He is reasonable. He has a brain. And now we can move forward from here since we're on the same page,
hopefully. I think that's a big part of why there are new people in there.
Oh, yes, 100%. People, even in progressive Seattle, the defund movement didn't go over well. No, in the long term, for sure. On Green Hill School and our failing juvenile justice system, and the adult who's sad he's being put in an adult prison, who's a convicted killer. Mm-hmm. Krista M. says he committed an adult crime. He is now an adult. He should have been moved to an adult prison long ago. And I've said that. The quickest change to fix what's happening in our juvenile detention facilities is to, if you are over the age of 18 and you have more time on your sentence, you go to an adult prison. Now, if you are going to complete your sentence before your 21st birthday, I think you should be able to stay in the juvenile detention facility and finish out your sentence there. But if that 3 years isn't enough to complete the sentence that was handed down to you, then you need to go to an adult facility. That'll solve the overcrowding problem. I think it will solve a lot of the crime that's happening within the juvenile detention facilities and will allow DCF to get a better handle on it. And it also just makes good sense. We don't need 25-year-olds, in some instances, convicted killers, people who have, you know, committed violent crimes. We do not need them in juvenile detention facilities. It's an easy change. DCYF and the legislature could do it this session if they want to, and they should. Kelly Dowell Tarp, once again, criminals and their rights are put above victims and families. This is crazy and needs to be changed. Focus should be on why they're there first. Address the overcrowding by moving them to adult prisons once they turn 18. Yes. And one of the other reasons for that, if you're a juvie and you go into juvie hall, but you have, let's say, 7 more years on your sentence. So right now, they're going to keep you in juvie hall from 18 to 25 and then unleash you for the last 2 years of your sentence on a state prison, and you think that they're going to be well-equipped to deal with the realities of hard prison time? Absolutely not. And it's never easy. Like, there's never a time where it's going to be easy to transition from a juvenile facility to an adult prison. But adult prisons also have minimum security, medium security. They have programs based on, you know, how you've behaved prior while incarcerated. They'll be fine. And if they're not fine, you killed someone. So sympathy is hard for me to come by. Loli Wilson, these young people have no fear. Ferguson wants no youth jail. Diversion is a joke. On press journalists and the state-sponsored media program that's starting this summer in Washington State, Bolt Up says, thankfully, there are still independent journalists such as Brandy, that's me, pointing out hypocrisy after hypocrisy. I appreciate it. We try, and an hour is never enough, which is why the show is always 90 minutes.
Never enough.
B. Larson, the Seattle Times has already hired a climate group to do most of their weather global warming climate crisis reports. Yeah, the Seattle Times has a climate lab that is funded by outside entities that support their reporting on climate. Now, I've said, I don't have an issue with that. You went out, you found a different funding source to do climate reporting specifically. They also have a similar funding model for their Project Homelessness. They say up front who funds it. They also say on there that those people don't have any editorial control over the content. Now, where I have an issue is where it seems like you aren't free to report on what you want to report on. Because if you look at some of the stories in the climate lab, you can see they've been called out as being completely inaccurate. Why is his name escaping me? Cliff Mass, the climatologist for UW, who has reached out to the Seattle Times on some of its climate lab reporting with actual facts and data and said, hey, you need to correct this story. It's not right. It was on snowpack in the mountains. And they didn't even respond to him. So you have to ask yourself, okay, if you've got like climate change activists funding your climate journalism, are you going to be honest about the CCA? Are you going to be honest that the Climate Commitment Act has raised gas prices? Or are you going to toe Jay Inslee's line where he says, no, it didn't. That's greedy gas and oil companies. I haven't seen a lot of stories, if any, out of the climate lab that have pushed back against some aspects of the climate agenda. So that's where
I think it's a slow takeover. It's kind of like our schools. It's been this slow takeover of indoctrination. And then with the Democrat-ran state that we live in and this slow takeover of, oh, we're not going to let you into this event if you don't always agree with us in the news. And so it's a slow kind of like get everybody on our side. Like we'll just make it hard for them to report on anything but what we want them to report on.
And if they do, the money dries up. They'll find a reason to say, we can't fund this anymore.
Or, I mean, well, if you can't get into any of your press conferences or if you can't get into these events, like Dow was not allowing Jonathan, things like that, then you're slowly like, you're not useful as a media source. So.
Right. Yeah. Jonathan Cho blocked physically from attending press events with the King County or executive's office.
Right.
And it's like, okay, so you're controlling the media over here that you don't like. Mm-hmm. You've declared, he said, you're not a journalist. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to fund people who you do think are journalists. Yeah. Like, that ought to go over well. And before somebody on the live chat says, Brandy, stop pruning. I just looked at my bangs. They didn't look good. So just let me prune, okay? My hair is getting so long. Let me prune. I always get called out. Brandy, stop fixing your hair on the live chat. I have a lot of hair, okay? Just up here, though.
Very long.
Only up here.
Wow.
Only.
You didn't need to go there.
You know, let's move on. Sergeant Pickles, I would rather sift through the free cesspool of Twitter news than give TV networks or newspapers a single cent of my time or money. Matthew Cook.
So it's on the pro wrestling. They say it.
Triple H
or Degeneration X is the one that made the X.
Oh, my God. So many of you guys knew that. Okay. Thank you. Yes, I remember Triple H.
I know.
The Undertaker.
Too. Oh, yeah.
Oh, The Rock.
The Rock. Mm.
The Rock's still doing it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm happily married. However, I think Mike knows that my, like, celeb crush, his is Miranda Lambert. Mm-hmm. Mine is The Rock. And that's fine. Like, that's fine. Robert Parker, $5 for a super chat. More Nicole camera time. She adds to Brandy's greatest. I love you grab that out, and she's like, "Yeah."
Well, no, it's $5 super chat. I had to, but yeah. Well, so when we're just to clarify, I mean, I'm doing a lot of things here, and when I'm putting stuff
she's producing
up on the screen,
a show,
I can't be on screen doing that, and so that's why I don't come on all the time.
But, she's producing a show. Plus, and then when I make her sing a song, she doesn't want to come on.
Yeah.
That's what? True. Let's just really just in the name of just like ending the show today. Let's sing something.
Oh, no.
Oh, come on. No. Like a patriotic song. You know how I love patriotic songs.
I have to have music.
Oh, beautiful.
Oh, geez. That's like the longest song.
Spacious skies. For amber waves of grain.
I don't even know how to add to
this. For purple mountain majesties. Mm-mm. Above fruity. Okay, I'm done. Sorry. Thanks. I love our country. What do you want from me? Okay, you're off the hook. You didn't contribute much to that. That's fine.
Didn't.
Mm-hmm. All right, you know, we're a little over today, so I'm going to make our closing sanity check super quick and easy. Go ahead. Vote. That's it. Please get your ballots in. I know that the primary election isn't till the 6th, but get them in early. You know, I know some of you are like, they're going to fiddle with my ballot. No, rip off the little tab, track your ballot, make sure it gets to where it's going. Make sure you have time to track your ballot and to make sure it gets to where it's going. Please vote for sanity. Please vote for change. 4 years, that's all we need to show people that there is a better way in Washington State. And one party rule is not the solution to our problems. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much. A special thank you to people who are tuning in via Twitter X. Oh my God, I'm sorry, Elon. Via X, we now have that live function up and running. So there are now 5 ways you can watch The Daily Show live. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Patreon, Locals, and do you have something to say, Nicole?
Oh, last second, super chat, $10 from Robert for the dual smiles on the first super chat. There you go.
Okay, love it. And if you want to support our show for $5 a month, we would love that. You also get access to our exclusive Sunday interview show, Sundays with subscribers, as well as partaking in our daily subscriber show polls. Sign up, $5 a month, undividedpod.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Goodbye.